Okay, so we're going balls to the walls with this. Our podcast is called Walk and Talk with Diana and Taylor. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Taylor.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm terrible. Thanks for asking. Just kidding. I like that podcast, and I just wanted an excuse to say it. I'm doing okay. Midterms, man.
I had one today. It was okay. I think because I studied so much, it really paid off.
Oh, good.
Honestly, after Hulse, I feel like now any test is easy. It was multiple choice. It was only a couple short responses. I think after our experience with critical theory, it was a breeze, so it was okay.
Here we are. Have you started thinking about your story for Mona's workshop on Monday?
I haven't, because I haven't read Mona's or Hunnivan's.
I don't want to read theirs until I've written mine. Usually I read the stories beforehand and feel like shit, but I feel like this is a special kind of shit, you know? Because Alice Munro isn't teaching me, but Mona Simpson is.
And because I have to present on Hunnivan's story, I think I'll have to, like, internalize some of that more.
What is the prompt? Pass down? Passing on something from, like, aunt to niece, bohemian to artist, something like that?
Yeah, like teacher to student.
I feel like that already comes across in your work, though.
Yeah?
Yeah, very naturally, not like in an inorganic or forced way. You really embed culture into your stories.
Thank you.
It's something that I admire. Want to go here around one more time?
Yeah.
Then maybe we can do a reading soon, if anything or anywhere moves you.
Sounds good.
But yeah, anyway, I think a lot of the time I worry that I'm writing the same thing like over and over again. So how do you like, do you ever feel that way?
I do. I think I didn't realize it as much, but when last week you mentioned that in my story I'd written apathy well, I thought about it for a really long time, and I realized that I write a lot of apathetic characters, or at least I write perspectives from very apathetic characters. And sometimes it makes me wonder, and it's something that sort of concerns me. I end up psychoanalyzing myself, you know? Am I the apathetic person? Is this about me? Or is it just like, no, this is just something I tend to occupy when writing, not a way of being that I live with from day to day. Do you ever wonder that when you're writing the thoughts of your characters, that those thoughts just run over in your head?
First off, you are not an apathetic person. I think you are one of the most sensitive and in-tune people I know.
Oh, save that for later.
I think the difference is, and what I'm fascinated by, is that you write apathetic characters who are active. Their action is passive. I'm thinking now of your story of the woman who liked to rescue people who wanted to jump off of buildings that you wrote in the fall. I just remember that you wrote about chrysanthemum tea, and I can't remember the title, but there's still action and movement, and it's that in-tuneness to the characters that you're writing that I appreciate. And what was the other question? What does it say about me?
Yeah, in terms of the thoughts you write for your characters or the plot you write for your characters, you know, how you feel you're connected to it as a person, as an author, or as a spectator of your own story.
I feel like when I give somebody my work, I am all but, like, taking my clothes off. I legitimately feel as if I'm stripping myself down, and I don't know if that's what anybody else wants, but it really feels like I'm betraying something inside of myself. Or not even betraying, but revealing, because it's not necessarily a negative thing. How are we doing on time, by the way?
We're at 17 minutes.
So we have some things. We should do our readings to know how long, and we can ask them things about that.
Yeah, I'll pull mine out.
Would you like to go?
I will go.
All right.
This is an excerpt from Los Angeles, Past, Present, and Future, Westwood Wired. Just as postmodernism was reactionary to the values of modernism, post-Disneyism was reactionary to the values of postmodernism. By the late 2020s, the jaded millennial generation was well aware of the ironies within large-scale societal structures, as well as the ironies of day-to-day life. While the use of memes codified some of the anxieties of millennials into acknowledgments of the main issues of the digital age, many millennials felt that the consumerist lifestyle was destructive yet impossible to escape from, without a societal revolution that would ultimately either be squashed by larger authoritative figures or fail to succeed at actually improving the lives of the people. They felt that postmodernism was too broad and too eclectic to properly reflect the futility of life. This collective hopelessness felt by the millennials in their 40s and 50s was distinct in providing the foundation of post-Disneyism. The movement has come to espouse characteristics like ironic minimalism, communication through crudely photoshopped images rather than words, and a bitterly felt combination of satire and praise for capitalism. In the past 20 years, one of the most discussed topics about individual rights has been the extent to which citizens' movements should be tracked. It is no secret that in cities across America, there are at least two cameras stationed on every block. The footage feeds back into an artificially intelligent data keeper for each city, though some cities like New York City and Los Angeles need at least three or four of these data keepers. The footage has been very helpful, even essential for police, to track down perpetrators of crime. However, in a 2061 hack of Chicago's data keeper's records, it has been revealed that the DK also had been predicting individuals' movements based on their daily routines in the city. Furthermore, the DK had reached out to mobile data banks to corroborate this information with smartphone GPS records. Residents in the Westwood area took the news in stride. In fact, one group in a coding club decided to make a hybrid reality mobile game out of it. On screen, Panopt reimagines Westwood as a dystopian post-war landscape, in which players take the form of shadowy blobs. Players can choose to be either the government or the citizen. For the government, the goal of the game is to stalk the citizen, another player that the game has selected at random, and predict where their final checkpoint is without getting caught. For the citizen, the goal of the game is to arrive at the final checkpoint without giving away the location. A secondary goal is to figure out which shadowy blob on the screen is the government, based on the familiar faces they see following them in real life. The citizen has three guesses. Though the citizen does not have to guess the identity of the government, if the government is caught, the citizen automatically wins.
Off script. I love your reading voice so much. It's always a pleasure to hear you read. Okay, first, I have two questions, and I'm going to say them now so I don't forget. The first has to do with nonfiction and academic writing, because this piece was for a class, correct?
Yes.
And then the next one is about speculative fiction and writing the future. Okay, the first one is, when you do write academic pieces, how do you maintain your voice? Because I have had to read a number of my peers' work, you know, like when you share things, and I find that I struggle to let go of my inclinations to make things fluffy. This isn't fluffy, though, but it still has your internal rhythm. So how is academic writing different from creative writing for you, and do you approach it with an interest in your own writerly voice?
I think, actually, my academic voice is not that different from my creative voice. My academic voice is just a lot more of, therefore, furthermore, a lot more transition words. In terms of, I guess, the way I construct my sentences, it is pretty similar, but the mindset that I have going into each is different. With my excerpt that I just read compared to the rest of the paper that I wrote, it sounds a little less academic. I have a speculative mindset to it. It's a long paper, 10 pages.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Earlier on in the paper, I was talking about design elements in Westwood as they are in 2017 and how I imagined they would change, and that just involved more research. But I guess for, societal reimaginations of Westwood, I think there is definitely more of a creative voice in it.
I really appreciate it. It was clear, but I knew it was yours. Then my other question is something you touched on about speculative fiction. I know I'm a fan of your speculative work, and I don't mean to force you into a genre, and I know that I've even mentioned it to Snelson. Hi, Professor Snelson. That I really wanted more speculative work from you, just thinking of your ACES piece and some things you wrote for Justin's workshop.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
I think speculative is hard.
It's hard to,
It's hard for people to take it seriously.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I can't even begin to understand how you do it. What I'm fascinated by is how you do it when you're writing pieces that aren't quote-unquote speculative. You still have a capacity to imagine the future. And all writing is making shit up, but as somebody, for me, I write a lot about the past, and your writing isn't particularly nostalgic. So how do you imagine the future, and what draws you to writing about it?
Well, I think that I'm a little pessimistic about the future, or I tend to be. I think a lot of my thoughts, not even as I'm writing, but just as I'm going about my day, I tend to think that the future could hold so much, and all of that just gets compounded in my writing. It's really interesting. I don't know. It's weird because I'm not interested in writing about post-apocalyptic...
About dystopia.
Yeah, that's the word. I tend not to write so much about dystopia as much about how technology is a part of our lives, and it's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It's just what it is, and I want to write about how people navigate around that, I guess.
I think ultimately your stories aren't about the speculative world that you're imagining. They're still grounded in your characters, and it's how your characters are responding to your environment. So the story isn't about the environment. It's about your characters in that environment.
Going back to you.
No, you don't have to do that.
You're really good at, I think a lot about the future and how the character would act in this situation. And it's more like difficult for me to do what you do, which is to connect to your characters on such a level that it's almost as if you live within the character's moment. I'm remembering the story you wrote last week, 2 weeks ago, where the girls are swimming in the pool, and there was that one detail I mentioned loving in the workshop, in which you had written in the sound of like the wet denim falling to the ground, that attention to detail gives not only your world life, but lets the reader know that this is what the character is focusing on, what they're noticing. So it's as if you're living in the character's mind as you are writing it, and it's incredibly vibrant. There's sort of a nostalgic tone to it, but it's not really sentimental. It's almost like mourning.
Me? Mourning? Never.
It's very beautiful. Maybe this can be a segue to a reading of your piece.
Okay, there's more swimming in this piece, so let's see if I have it on my phone.
Okay.
Summer home. 1. The kitchen. When I come back inside, lake water still clings to my skin. My mother asks me to please, for the love of... Will you dry off before you come inside? Her voice catches.
She's upset because of the wet spots on the kitchen tiles, or maybe it's the way my sister Annie slams the screen door on her way out. She's still irritated with Dad for breaking her favorite china last night. With lemon scent and Lysol, she scrubs the kitchen. I dry myself outside, watching my mother pace the stretch of the kitchen. She leans over the sink, her lips moving in a silent prayer, something I cannot hear from the other side of the door. I press my nose against the screen. To the front porch. Dad laughs deeply after I say that calling it a front porch isn't really accurate because it wraps all the way around our home, right? And it's not accurate. I am right. The porch hugs the body of the house, lined with flaxen lights and an off-white fence. In Dad's old lawn chair, I drink my mother's sweet tea. The electric jazz of cicadas carries across the lawn from the woods. I hear what I want to hear. The rough edges of Dad still laughing at what I said. The sky, shrouded in unseasonal clouds, bloats. There are no stars, no planes, as the kitchen light yields to the thickening dark. 3. The lake. On the banks by the lake, I suck the juice out of an overly ripe orange. I race Annie to the end of the deck, diving headfirst, shattering the lake surface. She lingers by the shallow end, still afraid of going too deep and never coming back. I stroke toward the center, toward where I can't touch the bottom. I float. I look back. There's my sister, no deeper than her knees, her shoulders growing crispy and her hair becoming golden. There's my mother, her cheeks red like crushed cherries, rubbing the back of her new boyfriend. There's the neighbors, there's their kids, there's the boy from one street over. There's a dog running without her leash, now the dog heads toward the water. I dive for the bottom of the lake. 4. The driveway. There are no fireflies. The sky stays blood orange late into evening. The boy from one street over stands beside me. The air smells of gamey flesh. We wait for the first boom of fireworks, the silver canvas then painted in yellows, oranges, reds, blues, whites, colors I can't name, colors I won't see again until I close my eyes and press hard against my eyelids. The tacky residue from the popsicle I sucked on earlier still sticks to my fingers. If he holds my hand, he'll know. My palms are heavy wet. I remember Dad's clumsy hands, the way he dropped the china, so spectacular and sudden, and the way my mother cleaned the filth from the kitchen counter, clutching her hands and her fiancé and his lemon-scented candles that christen his place in our summer home. Against the sound of fireworks next to the boy from one street over, the smoke stretches over the water from across the other side of the illuminated lake.
That was beautiful. My first question is, and I'll say my other questions later, structurally I noticed that your prose sounds a lot like poetry and your poetry sounds a lot like prose, and it's really interesting, your writing style, and I think it's quite beautiful because you're able to mix those two. In your head, how do you differentiate between prose and poetry? Is it less of a solid line, or you know?
It's nearly a non-existent line for me. I mean, I think the line is the line break for me. I went to an arts high school and I did creative writing for 4 years. Did. Creative writing. And my focus was in screenwriting and TV writing and long, long prose poetry. I mean, my assignments would be like 5 pages of poetry when everyone else had a stanza. And I think that's A, I don't know how to shut the fuck up. And B, I was always scared to do short fiction or proper prose. But I think that writing is about the image for me. I can't do plot, but I think that...
You do images beautifully. I will form this into a question later.
Thank you. For me, that's where it begins and ends. If it's not a character or a scene, it's that I want to write about that one description. Prose and poetry, when I write, I mean, they're inevitable for one another.
Right. So then I guess that my follow-up question is, does your brain just jump to images as you write? Do you think carefully about what images to put in before you write them in, either for your prose or your poetry? Because here I can, you know, taste the fruit, the orange that they're eating, when they're in the lake, when the speaker is jumping into the lake, when she's on the porch, when she smells the lemon-scented objects. You know, how do you come up with those images?
Perhaps it comes from some anxiety that I'm only ever saying the same thing over and over again. So it's like, how can I say the same thing but differently? And for me, that is the image. If I can live in a scene. And also I like to go through the world. I mean, it's not like I look at this tree and think the emerald indigo plant swayed deeply, but you know. But I also like really like sunsets. I feel like I'll never be able to describe the right shade of blue on a summer evening, and I'll never quite get right this orange and that pink, how they come together. But I'm going to keep fucking trying, so that's where I think comes down.
Yeah, I want to ask you, you love nature. You love Ohio.
God knows why, because like I could never go camping. I've got like a delicate stomach. Me and nature just don't seem like a good plan. I think I write about Ohio because it seems rich in imagery, and I've lived in Orange County and LA my entire life, which are not particularly nature-y. But for me, Ohio is just far enough, and I 100% fetishize Ohio, and it's just like the rural other for me. It feels like I can populate it as I want it.
That's beautiful. The first story you read in Mona's workshop, where the girl is trying to get eggs with her sister. Again, it's as if you've lived their life, you know, as if you've been fetching eggs every morning.
Plot twist, I actually live on a farm in Indiana, and I fly here every day. No, that one was about my mom. So for that, I like asked my mom, hey mom, tell me about the story when you and your sister Carrie got stuck in the mud. And that was the plot. Her outlining was everything. And then I was like, ooh, I get to describe mud in depth for four sentences.
It really drew us all in. Even though, you know, she was just getting the eggs and trying to do some chores, the way you described it was, I mean, you said you don't focus so much on story mechanics, right? But you have a really good sense of movement in your stories. It just comes so naturally.
I'm not going to disagree, but only because it feels like antithetical to what we're going to be doing shortly. But thank you. That's too kind. I do think, if anything, I know where I want a story to start. And on a good day, I know where I want it to end. So everything else in between is the difficult thing. I'll have the first image and the last image. The story with my mother, I knew I wanted her to get out of the mud. I wanted her to have that redemptive arc and for her to get herself out of the dirt. On a good day, I'll know how to end, and everything else in between is a shit show. Thanks, Diana.
Thank you, Taylor.
That was fun.
That was good. Okay.
You're good.
Yeah.
All right. Perfect. So our final segment is called Tough Love. And for this, we'll need some participation, which we've already vetted from you. But don't worry, you don't have to say anything again. Let's just say you'll need to be open to receiving. It's a bit of a game.
If you're willing to play, Taylor and I are going to tell you some things. And if you agree, you'll give us a thumbs up. If you don't agree, you'll give us a thumbs down. And we'll keep going until you get the gist of things.
This may fail spectacularly. I kind of hope it will. We'll see. It'll be wild either way. All right. Let's see. Who am I going to pick on first, since you all said yes? Polly. All right, so again, if you agree, thumbs up. If you don't agree, and you don't have to yet, thumbs down. Polly, I think that you write really natural, organic dialogue that is simultaneously effective but also very insightful to who your characters are. Excellent. Excellent. Yes.
Kalina, I think whenever I listen to your stories or read your stories, your sentence structure, your rhythm, and your voice is always solid.
All right, let's see. Madeline, I will always think of you as being one of the funniest writers I've ever read and been in workshop with, but lately the things you've been putting forward have just been so moving. So I think you really balance humor and heart well in your writing.
Evelyn, you're able to depict the scene very atmospherically, always in your stories, and you can write in dry, funny moments, like, just very well.
Hello, Professor Snelson. I don't know if we vetted you appropriately for this, but it's happening. I think you've done such an incredible thing with this class. I mean, everybody that I've talked to who's already taken this seminar before is like, that is so cool what you're doing. And again, like, I came into this with an idea of what I wanted to do, and it just felt like it kind of got pushed off the table in a really brilliant, destructive way, where I was like, there's so much more I can do. All right, thanks for tuning in. Like and subscribe. Follow us on YouTube. My SoundCloud will be in the
Twitter.
Description below. Twitter, Letterboxd, thanks. And
That's it.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, so yeah, that's my favorite way to end.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. I'm glad none of you gave us a thumbs down. Here's the thing. I talked with Professor Snelson about how to compliment you guys. And, like, this came from Jody, really, who got mad at me last week for not taking a compliment. And so I was going to just, like, compliment you all until you said,
quick,
oh, yes.
Can I get your silence?
Oh, yeah.
Unless you want this included.
Oh, no. We can let this go. Let it die.